Welcome to the Protocols webinar series presented by the Society of American Archivists Native American Archives section. This is webinar number 4, Native American Intellectual Property Issues, with guest interview with the Passamaquoddy People Project, hosted by Jennifer O'Neill. We would like to first highlight and thank our sponsors and partners who make this webinar series possible. First, the Society of American Archivists, as well as the Sustainable Heritage Network. Thank you for your support and funding. We also would like to thank the Society of American Archivists Native American Archives section for hosting and coordinating this webinar series. Additional information and resources about the protocols and the webinar series can be found on the Native American Archives section website by following this link below. Within the Protocols webinar series, we aim to cover one or more of the 10 core sections of the Protocols for Native American Archival Materials, which establishes best practices for the culturally responsive care and use of Native American archival materials, particularly materials that are housed in non-tribal institutions. Over the course of the past webinar sessions, we have highlighted building relationships of mutual respect, striving for balance in content and perspectives, accessibility and use, culturally sensitive materials, and providing context. And today we're highlighting the Native American intellectual property issues. In our next series, we'll also highlight other additional issues. On today's series, we highlight individuals from the Passamaquoddy People Project. This includes Donald Soctoma, the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Passamaquoddy Nation and a tribal member. Jane Anderson, who is an Associate Professor of Anthropology and Museum Studies at New York University. And Guha Shankar, a Folklife Specialist at the Library of Congress. This episode includes an in-depth conversation with the individuals who have coordinated and worked on the Passamaquoddy People Project. The webinar highlights the project and discusses the following topics related to Native American intellectual property issues: an overview and history of the Passamaquoddy People Project, the collaboration built between the Passamaquoddy Tribe and the Library of Congress, specific ways the project protects and enhances Passamaquoddy intellectual property rights, strategies, steps, and lessons learned in building relationships between the tribal community partners with the larger national repository, and highlights the use of the Local Context Project to protect Native American copyrights and intellectual property rights, as well as favorite memories and stories from the project shared by the individuals interviewed. The Passamaquoddy people at home on the ocean and lakes. This website can be found here at passamaquoddypeople.com. Utilizing the Mercadew structure and system, this project contains featured content like the history on birch bark, the 1890 Passamaquoddy phonograph recordings, as well as specific audio recordings. Additionally, on the website, you can browse by category, everything from books, cultural life, dances, to manuscripts, museum collection items, and people and portraits. For the conversation for this webinar series, it's specifically focused on the 1890 Passamaquoddy phonograph recordings. These are the recordings made during Jesse Walter Fweck's research trip to Maine in March of 1890. The trip was undertaken so he could test the Edison phonograph in field conditions and bring back sample recordings to various groups and university in Boston before his trip to the Southwest later that year. These recordings were the first ethnographic phonograph recordings ever made and were pivotal in further fieldwork with the Edison phonograph. After Fweck's work with the Passamaquoddy, he went on to publish many journal articles and transcriptions of Passamaquoddy stories, which can also be found in this collection. This project specifically highlights the initiative and work between the Library of Congress and the Passamaquoddy tribe. To put within this project is the importance of both not only highlighting the records from the American Folklife Center, which are highlighted here, but the way that the Mercadoo platform then also allows the system to include the Passamaquoddy record, where the Passamaquoddy tribe then work to include the cultural narrative, traditional knowledge, and the traditional knowledge labels focused here. Within this conversation today, they will include examples of this work, highlighting recordings, as well as how the traditional knowledge labels were included. For example, a traditional knowledge label here is also given a traditional Passamaquoddy word noted here, and specifically then is attached to a record to denote traditional intellectual property rights owned by the tribe. This is to ensure that the tribe and the Library of Congress are working together to denote and ensure specific traditional knowledge labels that are tied to each of these audio recordings. So in the conversation today, all members of the project that we interviewed will be highlighting how that worked and the specific ways this works to ensure the protection of Native American intellectual property rights. We hope that this conversation provides an opportunity for you to see a concrete practical example of implementing traditional knowledge labels to protect Indigenous intellectual property rights and helps you to understand ways that this can be done. We hope that you follow us and send us questions either through Facebook or Twitter, and you can see both of those links here on how to follow us. We will be following up with a protocols implementation toolkit later in winter 2020 and into 2021. This is developed over the course of the webinar series and will be the last part of the webinar series as we launch this larger project. We hope this has been useful for you, and please follow up with any questions after you watch this interview today. Thank you so much. Well, welcome everyone. I'm Jennifer O'Neill. I am a professor at the University of Oregon teaching in the Department of Indigenous Race and Ethnic Studies. I'm a member of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, and I've been hosting these protocols webinars where we are highlighting some of the largest categories and tenets of the protocols for Native American archival materials in order to bring educational resources and curriculum and toolkits to the larger membership and really anyone that wants to know more about the protocols, how to implement them, but also just what does it take to practically implement the protocols. So we're really trying to present some basics of that and talking with people who have done this for numerous years so that other people can learn from those who have been doing it, what's worked, what hasn't worked, and how that other people can implement these in their repositories. So today I'm honored to be joined by some amazing people who have been working on an incredible project for numerous years. And through talking about this project, we're really going to be highlighting one of the larger tenets of the protocols, which is about intellectual property rights, specifically related to Native American communities and the preservation of intellectual property in those collections. So today I'm very excited to be welcomed by first Jane Anderson, who she is an associate professor of anthropology and museum studies at New York University. I'm also pleased to welcome Guha Shankar, who is a folklife specialist at the American Folklife Center, and Donald Soktoma, who is from the Passamaquoddy tribe, who is a tribal historic preservation officer. And today they're going to be highlighting and talking about the ongoing collaborative project between the Passamaquoddy tribe and the Library of Congress and the local context initiative, which has helped to ensure that the recordings that they've worked on could preserve intellectual property rights of the tribe. And specifically, they're going to be highlighting the Ancestral Voices Project, which is a project to digitize, curate, and expand access to multiple recordings that were made in March 1890 by anthropologist Jesse Walter Foex. And So they're going to highlight this project in this conversation, as well as to give some practical insight into what it's actually taken to do this project and what it might look like for others that want to take a project like this on, particularly highlighting intellectual property rights and preserving those for Native American communities. So to start us off, I'd love to have Donald introduce yourself. If you could tell us a little bit about yourself and your involvement with the project, and then we'll have Jane and Guha also introduce themselves as well. So welcome, Donald.
Well, thank you. Well, my name is Donald Soktoma, from the Passamaquoddy tribe in eastern Maine. And we have a small community across the river in Canada. I've been working as the historic preservation officer for about 15 years now. Before that, I worked as the tribal legislature in the Maine House of Representatives for 8 years. And before that, I worked in the Tribal Forestry Department running management of 130,000 acres. My work on the Waxahachie project started a few years ago when I heard the first attempt to try to decipher some of these old recordings. And because the technology wasn't up to par at the time, the tribal linguist only went so far and couldn't complete it because the pronunciation from the old Waxahachies, I think at the time when Fuchs was recording it, it was trial and error. So it's always been in the back of my mind to hopefully keep track of technology, and something would come up to make them more clear. And then the right moment happened at a conference in Washington, D.C., where I met Guha's and Jane and told them my hopes. And they said, oh, this is the right time, the right place. And so we've been involved with the project, I don't know how many years now, 4 or 5. Years with the new technology and trying to get a system up and going where we can recreate these wax cylinders using today's speakers so we can listen and understand and teach the next generation. So that's about it.
Thank you, Donald. It's so wonderful to hear about how that all started and your involvement, and we'll delve a little bit more into that as we go along, but thank you. Guha, you want to share a little bit about your background and also how you became involved with the project?
Sure. At the center, I think you already mentioned it, Jennifer, I'm a senior folklife specialist. I've been part of the center staff since 2004, let me say, many, many years now, and I'm a public sector folklorist, which means to say that I've spent my adult sort of professional career between the libraries, American Folklife Center, and previous, many years previous to that, at the Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage at the Smithsonian. I came to the particular project that we're talking about, Ancestral Voices, when I first met Kim Kristen, who is as we know, the developer and the sort of the leading mind behind the Mukurtu content management system. And we were talking about ways and means of how we could find the mechanism or the instrument, platform, what have you, to get Native American cultural heritage materials back to communities of origin. And this would be the digital equivalent of what the center did in its founding days in the 1970s. And Donald has already alluded to it. The Jesse Walter Fuchs recordings, which were in the possession of the Harvard's Peabody Museum, that became one of the first collections that then-director Alan Jabbour brought into the center in the late 70s, somewhere about 1978 or 79. And that predates my arrival by about a decade, actually, at the center, or more than that. And at that time, just again to sort of dovetail on what Donald said, in those days, preservation from these archaic and obsolete media were made onto reel-to-reel preservation tapes, and then to cassette copies for listening. And the cassette copies were what David Francis, the linguist that Donald had alluded to, had been talking about. Those very scanty and very bare bones sort of translations and recordings that Mr. Francis was able to decipher from the technology of the time was included or incorporated into the Federal Cylinder Project catalog, the volume, the many volumes that were produced. And the one person who I think was instrumental and has had sort of a maintained a relationship with the project and with Native American collections has been our reference librarian par excellence, Judith Gray. And she was there at the time when David Francis came, did what he could to decipher some of those recordings, did some translations and so on. Fast forward to the 2011 actually, along the time that Kim Christian and I had been talking, I also met Jane Anderson, who was interested in trying to see how the traditional knowledge attribution labels, which she had developed to work in consort with Mukurtu, could be used to append attributions to the any number of the recordings and or other cultural heritage items we had at the library. So serendipity being all of that, as Donald said, in 2015, he came to the library to attend the ATOM conference. We had been in conversation with Jane and Kim about what collections we might possibly use for the traditional knowledge labels project. And again, prior to that, a few years earlier, about 2011, James Billington, who was then the director of the library, had enjoined us to take a look again at the wax cylinders, which we had converted to tape back in the days of tape preservation, as I've mentioned, and try to bring cutting edge technology like Archiphone, non-contact, laser pickups and reproduction technologies and digital enhancement and sound preservation and sound enhancement to extract the very best quality sound that we could from these archaic materials. And so the very first materials that we took aim at, I mean that in the sense of that we wanted to focus on, were the 1890 Jesse Walter Fuchs recordings of Passamaquoddy. So it was a really interesting concatenation of events that led to these sort of independent streams sort of linking up together. To sort of bring that sort of in a portion off to a close, since I could say 2016 or so, there's been a process of transferring the cylinders to digital files, working with them, with our engineering colleagues at the National Audiovisual Conservation Center at Culpeper, to do the kind of sound enhancement which Donald and his colleague and a fellow citizen at the Passamaquoddy Nation, Dwayne Toma, have said has really enhanced the ability of the communities of origin, in this case the Passamaquoddy people, to understand and uncover all of these different layers of meaning and rich cultural heritage that are embedded very deep in the very, very funky grooves of the old wax cylinder technology. And so we've seen that project come to fruition. There's still work to be done. Donald is doing some work on enhancing the cultural records. We've ingested and incorporated those records into the Library of Congress catalog records online. And I hope Jane will show you those records. I believe she will at the end of this session. And so that's where we stand. We just continue to do the work and move forward with the guidance and insights of the folks at Passamaquoddy. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Guha. That gives us a good idea of just like, how all of you have come together and how kind of this evolved over the years, which has been amazing to watch from the outside as well, just seeing what you all have been able to create, especially surrounding different angles, both the preservation of the recordings, but then also been leading into ensuring the intellectual property rights through the traditional knowledge labels. So now we'll turn over to Jane, who can both introduce herself as well as tell us a little bit more about how that evolved, as well as tell us a little bit about the Local Context Project, which we'll get into a little bit more as well.
Great. Thank you so much for having us, Jennifer. It's wonderful to be part of this series. I'm joining you all from Lenape Hoking from New York. I want to begin by paying my respects to the ancestors and to past, present, and emerging leaders, and to recognize that the Lenape Nation still hold an important place on this island, and that continued presence is felt. I'm a professor at New York University, and I'm the co-founder of Local Contexts and developer of the Traditional Knowledge Labels, which really began as a project in around 2010, 2011. And it's been a really interesting project, partly because it was developed as a response to the limitations of intellectual property law in relationship to Indigenous interests. And in many ways, the limitations there are kind of recognizing how copyright law in particular has also functioned as a tool of dispossession of Indigenous knowledge. Indigenous people are not recognized as the authors or the owners of their cultural heritage within institutions, and the law has facilitated that. And so in many ways, understanding those histories and understanding how colonialism gets built into our laws is a really important kind of project. So I guess I was quite frustrated with the possibilities of what could happen within the law. And I have a intellectual property law background. And I was kind of thinking about what else could we do? What else is available? What else is possible here? And also recognizing that not only is law or copyright law a tool of colonial dispossession, in no way can it recognize the complexity of Indigenous cultural protocols in terms of how Indigenous communities want to be sharing their knowledge and the different kinds of restrictions and limitations that exist in relationship to that. So we developed these labels as a kind of extra legal, and extra legal means beyond the authority of existing law, and a kind of educational project to help people understand the cultural protocols that exist and always existed with these materials, but have been routinely ignored, erased, or excluded from library catalogues. Often you don't even find that information in any kind of subject field. It's just not there. And so in many ways, the TK labels are a project to bring cultural protocols back into cataloging and classification systems. But alongside that, it has also meant that we need to think about transforming the digital infrastructures themselves that maintain biases and those exclusions. And so the project with Passamaquoddy and with Donald and with the Library of Congress kind of came at a really good time. And as you said, Donald, we're all kind of at this conference together talking a little bit about the wax cylinders. And there was just a moment where we just all got together and it was like, okay, let's see what we could do. I don't think any of us had any sense that it would become the project that it became, or it would be actually do the foundational work that it's been doing to return authority to Passamaquoddy, to allow for that reclamation and for that kind of assertion of rights that that exist in that material and that have been, you know, not recognized as existing with it properly over the long periods that it's been in other institutions, that it hasn't been with Passamaquoddy. And then I think that there's interesting pieces there in terms of, you know, because of this project, what now is happening And this is, I think, what is it also exciting, what it opens up for community work that's happening now that Donald's doing with those cylinders and connecting them into a different kind of temporal framework, connecting the ancestors to the present generations and expanding those songs into dances and kind of across multiple communities. So hopefully we can kind of get into that, because it's not just only what intellectual property is or does or has, you know, has foreclosed. It's what challenging those systems and breaking them open can mean in as a future. And I think that that is kind of really where the possibility of the labels sits, in terms of how they change something for a future.
Yeah, and you put it so beautifully. It is not only about actually doing the project and acknowledging Indigenous ownership and their own copyright to these materials, especially for communities, but then how do we challenge, how can we take that further, and what else can come out of these projects, especially for so many tribal communities who are trying to regain ownership, who have always had ownership of their materials, but have lost some of that power for materials that have ended up in other repositories. So I think that might be one of my first more in-depth questions for you all, is for any either, particularly I'm asking from the perspective of a tribal community who knows where their materials are and wants to engage in a similar project in trying to collaborate with or ensure that their protocols and traditional knowledge and property rights are it somehow infused or really, again, takes that back. If they're trying to do that, what recommendations would you give to both the tribal community and then also to the repository who wants to take on a project like this, specifically now that you have been working on it now for maybe 4 or 5 years, specifically this project, and even longer for local context? But for those that are wanting to take this work on and really implement it, what are some good lessons learned that you have, or what recommendations would you give to both tribal communities and to the non-tribal repositories that want to collaborate together on this? And whoever wants to ask or go ahead can go ahead and answer.
Well, let me take a stab at that, I suppose. And I'll bring this to you from the institutional perspective. And I go back, as I said, a little bit longer into our own institutional history. The institution that tribal communities and community members will want to deal with, you have to try to figure out whether or not there is the will and the desire for engagement between the repository and the tribal community. And this is not always the case, unfortunately, in the sense that the American Folklife Center, since its inception, has been committed as our part of our mission as a special collections division within a large institution to engage frequently, often to the extent possible, with communities of origin who are, after all, the people who have created the cultural records that we hold in our institution. That I think is fundamental. You also have to know that within the center, American Folklife Center, where I work, there's also, you know, our directors and leadership, particularly in the form of, say, Betsy Peterson, who is the director of the center, and Nikki Saylor, who is the head of the archives, are both committed because of our own particular backgrounds in academic and otherwise in public sector work. We have a commitment to engaging with communities of origin, and ultimately it all comes back as well to the former director, Alan Jabora, I mentioned before, whose vision was that the cultural heritage records that we have in our holdings ultimately belong in a kind of very specific sense to the communities of origin, to those people who created them. So that's something which you have to figure out, and that's something which can only be done on a basis of communication and a kind of an open and honest dialogue as to what the limits and possibilities are. In our case as well, in terms of trying, you know, you may find out where the materials are, and it's certainly easy enough to get copies back from many, not easy, but I mean, it's part of the process which governs access at many repositories. But you also have to have, in our case, we were fortunate and gifted, we were gifted with the presence of somebody like, say, Jane Anderson and Kim Christian, and Jane specifically, who has longstanding work and longstanding interest and an ethical responsibility, and I don't mean to put words in her mouth, but I think we all know where she stands, in working on a collaborative basis with indigenous communities to return materials back to them. So that's something else that maybe we're fortunate in that sense. And I'm not sure that this necessarily is, and I say this by means of saying there's no template to the work we're doing. It's all in a very individualistic basis. It's all on a case-by-case basis. And then the other thing, obviously, critically, the most important factor is what is the will and the desire on the part of the indigenous communities to make that commitment to chasing these records down. If you look back on the long arc of this particular project, we're talking about 1979. The elder David Francis did has now come to fruition, lo, some 40 years later. And David Francis, unfortunately, did not live to see that project of his come to light, where those records were, as Jane and Donald will tell you, further have really invigorated, I think, a sense of community and revitalized and animated that spark. But you know, even as we remember and celebrate David Francis, we're also saddened by the passing of, say, Molly Neptune Parker, another great elder and a great voice. And I know a friend and longtime colleague of Donald, and also somebody whom Jane worked with. So it's, and I say that by means of saying that it's a game of attrition in some ways, because the most important resources are the people. The cylinders are really something, but all those folks I mentioned, from the repository level to the community level to the partners we have in universities, those are unique. And just trying to figure out how to negotiate and navigate that, I can't give you a template, but those are all the pieces which are necessary for this project, and it may be necessary for other projects as well. And again, I'll defer to Jane and Donald, who work in their own ways with other tribal communities, and also Donald's working with community-based institutions like the Abbey and so on at home. Are also interested in this. So there's a lot of keywords I can pull out later and pass on to you, but that's how I see how all of these things sort of work together in that very symbiotic way, I would say, and also happy accidents. Does that make sense to you all, I hope?
Yeah, that's great. Donald and Jane, you want to build upon that?
I think one of the most important things for a project like this to take off is you have to have that desire in the community to see it forward. You have to have the resources, people resources available that we're working on a wax cylinder that are speaking the native language. And native language across the country right now is, I hate to say it, is slowly disappearing. But we're lucky with my tribe. We have quite a bit of fluent speakers, and a lot of them wanted to take this project on. Because the cylinders were so old, and over, I'd say, every 100 years, languages change, and it changed a lot in our community. The words, we call it the old Passamaquoddy language, where the words are about a foot long. And today they're shortened up a little bit. There's less fluctuation in the voices. But we had in our community some people that understood the old language and were fluent in the modern day language. So we had the desire in our community. We had the people in our community. It's a lot different when you have a linguist from the outside come and try to interpret your language. But if you have the community speakers that can do it, that really grinds it into homegrown, you know. So it was important. And when I started with this project, I spent some time with David, and David Francis, you know, he kept talking about the wax cylinders, and he'd tell me stories about the wax cylinders. So that stayed on my mind. And we tried a couple techniques after talking with Jane and Guhas, because my thoughts were just to get them translated and that's it. And then Jane said, well, let's build some metadata. And then talking more, let's put this on a cultural website where you can control access and add more material as you gather it from the community. So having that, the big picture really gets you thinking about the real history and what you can do to try to make this as good as possible for the next generation.
Thank you, Donald. That's really great. And you bring such a good perspective about, yeah, there has to be both the people resources, the desire on the side of the people, and that knowledge that they bring is so important. And I really liked what you said about ensuring that you have, it's so much better to have a community member to be, have that language rather than relying on someone from the outside, and to have that really important big picture so you can continue to have some longevity with the project. Jane, do you wanna talk a little bit as well?
Sure, I mean, I'll just use what Donald said as a kind of a jumping off point for thinking about, what became really evident in the life of this project, and the life of this project is ongoing, was not, we often, how do I say this a bit better? It's not only about the intellectual property piece, right? The intellectual property piece is one piece that we had to navigate. And that was much like all the other pieces we had to navigate, whether it was kind of the institutional will. And definitely this project was really only possible because there was a commitment at an institutional level to be doing this work. And there had been for a very long time. This wasn't the first project that the Library of Congress was doing. There was a deep commitment to recognizing an inequity, right? A deep commitment to recognizing an inequity that had kept an enormous amount of material from communities. And that if that has to be the first point at an institutional level, it's recognizing not only that inequity is there, but what the consequences of that inequity have been for communities. And then there's the, negotiating the ownership part and or the intellectual property part, which on one hand was, kind of relatively straightforward. I would say it was almost the smaller part of the project, even though what we've been able to do with that is incredibly important and meaningful in terms of rerouting the structures and recognizing the authority and control and ownership of those recordings and making sure that they're now placed where they always should have been, which is with Passamaquoddy. And thinking about that piece, but it's more all the work that happened around the recordings, I think, that was so generative and incredible at a community level, but also how it changed people's understandings of those recordings in the institutional level as well. So in many ways, the labels were a tool. They weren't necessarily an answer. They were a tool to help move a whole lot of questions forward that needed to have all Passamaquoddy voices at the table, needed to be having that conversation with an institution like the Library of Congress, and also making sure that those Passamaquoddy cultural protocols are recognized not only with those recordings as they exist and are sung now, but are also recognized and exist within the infrastructures of the institution as well, right? So there's a certain kind of enduring permanence of those cultural protocols that is now there that previously wasn't there. And that's also changed, I think, this would be interesting to kind of get from Donald, this would be a question I ask back to Donald, is I think that what the labels did, or actually addressing that, addressing the intellectual property, like not sweeping it under the carpet, not saying, oh, we won't, it's not going to. It meant that there was a different level of trust around what was actually happening in the process. Mm-hmm. And so all these things are differently attentive to relationships and to long-term relationships and to ancestral relationships, as well as future generation relationships. And what is it that allows us to kind of create conditions of possibility for trust building in contexts where that trust is really low, would be an understatement. So I think, you know, for again, like, we worked, the IP piece was actually a small piece, but by addressing it, by putting it there, by actually thinking about it and actually thinking hard about it, it opened up something else. And I feel like that was something that was really amazing about this project. When you ignore intellectual property, or you ignore the historical conditions that lead to exclusion of rights and interests, you're doing a major disservice by not addressing them as you move forward, because they are still there. They'll still be there, and they'll still haunt collections. They'll still be the pieces that make collections unusable, make the fact that communities can't control them, that disallow engagement with collections. And so, you know, they have to be at the forefront of our thinking, not as a kind of afterthought or a maybe. And so, Donald, so my question back to you, Donald, is, like, we were doing all this work, and it became really important that there were so many people in the community that started to have trust in a process, that and more people came and to become part of this project. And I think that's one of the success stories of this project, is that it actually became a Passamaquoddy project. And you've carried all these other parts of it forward by doing all this next stage of work. But by dealing with that ownership piece and actually putting ownership back where it should have been, that was a key part of what that next level of trust could be.
Yeah, I didn't really think about, in the beginning, I didn't think about ownership of a song, because I knew it was a tribal song, so I always thought it belonged to the tribe. It's sort of like our concept about land, you know, we don't think about ownership of land, but everybody else does, and we end up losing it. So I guess my thinking was in the same way as I think about land. Nobody really owns it, but when you come down to it, it's like tribal land. And the songs, I never thought, you know, until I talked with you, Jane, I never thought about the ownership or the right, cultural rights, because I always thought it was a tribal song, we own it. But I guess out in the world, everybody wants to claim ownership and take away. And I've seen that happen so many times in my culture, where somebody will transcribe a story, a legend or a tribal story, and write a book, and then they're the owners of that story, you know, and the tribe doesn't even get credit for the story. So I'm glad the connection was made, because, yeah, you're right, we have to address these issues.
Yeah, I think Donald and Jane, you hit on really what is so important about a project like this, that it really highlights the importance of how wrong people have gotten it around intellectual property rights for tribal communities. Just like how Donald says, we've always owned our materials, but because somebody else has come in or claimed ownership or has taken it somewhere else, then it's forced this questioning of our ownership of our materials, which we know we've always had that ownership, but because it's like that secondary, somebody else wanting to claim ownership or physically taking it somewhere else, that has forced us to have these conversations. And I really like how Donald put that, because that's also how I try to just explain a lot of these concepts to, whether it's other archivists or historians or students, that for Indigenous ways of knowing, or just Indigenous ways in our communities, that's our property rights are never questioned by our communities, but what's happening is they're questioned by outsiders and questioned by repositories where we always know where that intellectual property or ownership lies. And I just really like how Donald framed that. So thank you so much, because it's good to hear other people talking about it in that way. And that's the same way I really try to explain it to other people. And it's for other non-Native people, it's just a completely different way of thinking about the world and how it operates, and coming from this Indigenous perspective. So thank you so much for explaining it in that way, especially highlighting that the intellectual property issues, and again, Jane and all of you, I think, commented on this, that while that was an issue and one of the main tenets of the project, really at the heart of it was everything else. It was the trust building, the relationships, the long-term project that was really going on. And so one of the things I was hoping, and maybe one of the last questions I could have you talk about before we jump into showing some of that, the actual website, was I'm curious to know, now that you have been in this project for now quite a few years, and you've built these relationships and partnerships, and you've seen this collection grow into so many different things that you couldn't have even imagined, maybe what's your favorite memory of working on this project together, or just maybe one of the most surprising things that has come out of it, or just any other memories that you'd like to share in the partnerships that you've built together?
Well, the first meeting that was really stayed in my mind, meeting people that were interested in helping the tribe get ownership, get the music back. That very first meeting was really powerful for me. The next meeting, playing some of the songs for the children. We had a language school going for 3 to 5 year olds, and we had fluent speakers from the community teaching the kids. And when we played the music for the children, one of the teachers started singing it. And she said that she heard it from her grandmother. And so that, you know, sometimes you don't think about how knowledge is passed on, and right there it just popped up. So I knew I had a source of history and some information. And then the children, she said, come back in a month and you'll hear all these kids singing that. Sure enough, I went back in a month and they were all singing it. You know, a song that wasn't sung for 130 years. And the next moment was going to Washington and taking Duane Toma. He's the one that's working on the translation, and meeting all the people from the Library of Congress that have worked on the wax cylinders from the past, and the current workers, and just seeing the glow in their eyes when their work come full cycle around, that was very powerful for me. And seeing Duane singing that first song in front of them really invoked a lot of emotion coming out of Duane and people in the audience that worked with these cylinders. It was very, very powerful. I'll never forget that moment, because I felt that energy. And then just taking it back to the community and continually gathering information on each song, on each story, seeing the interest in people, just they spark right up when I tell them that who sang this song, how they're related to this person, how old these are, the oldest in the nation, you know, the oldest in the world. These recordings are the field recordings. So that's what I remember. And, you know, the friendship that we have with Jane and Guha's on, you've got to have a good relationship for this to proceed, because there are some moments when you're trying to work on something like this and you get a little bit frustrated because of every, you know, other things going on in the world, and trying to put something together the best you can for future generations, and you get a little frustrated, and it's always good to pick up the phone and call Jane, and Jane's always there with, yeah, no, you gotta, this is what I do. And she always had something, she had a way of saying things that was good, and she's sort of like a magnet in the community. Everybody just loves her. So that was pretty much it.
Those are some wonderful memories, Donald. That's so, so wonderful to hear. Thank you for sharing those wonderful memories that you all have built together. And I'm sure, Jane, you have some as well. Would you like to share as well?
I was going to share all the ones that Donald shared, because they're all amazing. I guess the one that I would add, and I think this is also really important, because it speaks to just the challenges of what the documentation exists around some of these materials. And as we were kind of going over them and looking at, you know, the paucity of what we had, and also the different places where some of this information was, often the full information is not within one institution, it's in another institution. And so you kind of got to deal with the distributed kind of knowledge project that kind of put something here and put the field notes here, and that you have to kind of pull back together as kind of part of a epic jigsaw puzzle. Was on one of the recordings. We just didn't know there was a third voice on one of the recordings. We knew there were two singers had been named.
Yeah. But
we didn't know who the third person was. And so we ended up doing all this like crazy research in another archive to kind of find out who this singer was. And then when we were able to locate who it was and kind of like, you know, check it and double check it and double check it at Passamaquoddy, which is really where the real checking was, and realizing it was Molly Neptune Parker's great ancestor. And so to have Molly be able to connect with these recordings and hear her great-great-grandfather, and to be doing all of the work that she was doing, translating and contextualizing and, you know, connecting across time and making it in this moment. And I remember the one moment is like with the speakers on the baby high chair as she's listening to her ancestor sing a song, and she's then translating and thinking about what that might mean, just kind of this whole dimension of that. And so Molly's work was so important in this project, and I think her loss is enormous, and I just wanted to include that memory in this work too.
Yeah, that's wonderful to hear. Yep. Just, yeah, her memory is so important. Guha, do you want to share as well?
Well, I'm sorry, I cut out there for quite a long time, so I'm not sure if perhaps Donald mentioned, you know, we're talking about the memories that of this project, and I think the very first one, the first trip I ever made to Calais in the company of Jane and Kim, and we had gone back with the digitized recordings, and for the library and for the American Folklife Center, it was one of those moments which harkens back, I think, to this notion of digital repatriation, where I actually physically handed over the copies of the recordings to the group of elders who were assembled there. And I remember we met at the Wabanaki Cultural Center in a little room, going to have a little listening care center came in. So there's this whole kids, all sort of trooping in the door with the elders and with in the grandmothers and mothers and so on. And I just said, okay, well, we'll take it for what it is. We're going to listen. We're going to have have people listen to what we're talking about, started playing back the recordings. And the minute I started playing back the recordings, the kids who were running around the room all stopped dead in their tracks and started paying attention. And I understood then that as part of the cultural protocols that obtain within the community is that children are taught to listen, and they're taught to listen to songs, and they're taught to engage, and they're taught to like have a really pay close attention to what's being said, the voices of the elders and the voices of the ancestors. And right about that moment when, you know, I'm observing that, and I think I said, I don't know what this song is called. It's called the Traitor Song. And Gracie Davis, Miss Davis, spontaneously starts drumming on the table, and she starts singing a version of the Traitor Song recorded on the wax cylinders from 1890, which she reached back to her memory as a child, I don't know, 50, 60 years earlier perhaps. And, you know, I think Jane or Kim and I were sitting around talking, and we capture that moment, Donald captured that moment, and we have this amazing recording of Gracie Davis singing the Traitor Song. And I think at that moment, you know, it sort of crystallized for me what the power of the collections that, you know, we in non-Native institutions don't even realize the level at which it affects people. And that is that kind of cultural sort of memory. It activates those kinds of deep familial connections. And so here's Gracie Davis, you know, interpreting and taking on a song which has barely been heard in the community, you know, since 1890, but, you know, it still has a really important valence in the contemporary moment. And I think that's probably my favorite moment. I think Jane or Kim or I said, we could have just left the recordings and just gone home, because that's really the moment at which the recordings had come home, right? In that kind of really brilliantly fulsome way, which as an archivist, we just don't have that ability to connect with the people with whom our collections make a real impact upon. We're there doing our jobs, and we sit and we like do metadata remediation, and we like correct spellings and so on. But at that level of the community speaking back to the record we have in our collection, that to me is fundamental to what we do and the work that we do. So that's my memory. I don't know if you guys remember it the same way or not, Donald and Jane, who were in the room at the same time.
Yeah, sounds like an amazing memory. And I think I have heard you talk about that moment before. I think you talked about it in one of the conferences you all presented at. So I think that really does get at the heart of why we do this work and why we approach it in this way. Because like you said, the community is the one who really has that power over the knowledge and over the materials, and archivists can only take it so far and do so much, but then at some point it needs to go back to the community, or the community, the most power comes from where the collection came from. So it's so important that, like you said, there's that cultural memory activation that occurs that's so important. And it's amazing to hear these stories that you all have developed and created. And that is such a beautiful thing that happens when you engage in these types of projects. So hopefully people can understand that and see that that's such a huge part of this project. I think one of the huge last things we'd love to highlight is just seeing the actual website that's been created and where some of these recordings live in the Mercado platform for the Passamaquoddy site, as well as what some of the local contexts through the traditional knowledge labels look like. So I think Jane's gonna walk us through that. So I'm gonna pause our recording just quickly so we can bring up the page, and then we'll have Jane and others walk us through that. Okay, so we have Jane here who's gonna show us the Passamaquoddy people site and tell us a little bit about it and walk us through it. We're also gonna link this when this discussion is posted on the Sustainable Heritage site. So you'll have the link to it as well. But she was gonna walk us through this, as well as Guha and Donald can jump in here as well to show us some highlights of this amazing site that they've created for this project.
So I think that I'm going to defer to Donald pretty quickly in relationship to this. And it's also important that we start with the Passamaquoddy site, which is built on Mukurtu CMS. But I think, and I'll hand it over to Donald in one second. What was really important about this was pointing authority away from the institution that held the recordings back to the community whose recordings they are, and that allowed for a different kind of assemblage of histories and stories and narratives that were actually Passamaquoddy, and having that told from Passamaquoddy standpoint was critically important. I mean, it was almost the central need of the project to some extent. And so, I mean, Donald, do you want to talk just a little bit about that photograph? Because that photograph was such an important photograph that was chosen for the front of the site.
Yeah, the photograph is symbolic of almost a story of the wax cylinders. Mm-hmm. We started this trip. We have two communities, one upriver in the freshwater of the St. Croix, and one in the saltwater of the Passamaquoddy Bay and Atlantic Ocean. For so many years, that journey wasn't taken because dams were in the way, log drives coming down the river, and myself and my neighbor said, let's connect the community through the river. And me and him got in the canoe, and it was during the ceremonial days, and I took my wampum belt that my great-grandfather had, and we carried the wampum belt from the fresh, we call it the freshwater village on the St. Croix River, to about 60 miles, and we canoed down the St. Croix into the salt water to, it was a two-day trip, carrying the wampum belt and delivering it to the chief of the saltwater village. And the wampum belt is really a powerful symbol in our culture. So we connected the communities through following the ancestors' currents in the river and on the ocean. The next year, we planned the same thing, and we had 10 people go with us. 25 years later, 70 people are coming down the river with us to deliver the wampum belt to the chief and bring message. So every trip, we have somebody singing on the canoe. These last few years, since Dwayne's been involved with the Wax Cylinders, he sung the Wax Cylinder songs coming down the river. And a couple of the songs are the traveling songs that he sings, and they echo across the bay when everything's dead quiet. And he hits a drum, and you can hear the drum hitting on the east side of the bay, and the west side echoes back. And then he lets out his voice, and you can hear it echoing, and then everybody joins in. That's why this photograph is so important for the project, because it's symbolic of the ancestors have never left us. They've always been there. We just have to listen to them. And with the words of these wax cylinders from the ancestors, we're listening again. So that's what it means to me. So with every song, with every picture, every journey, we wanted to do a welcome in the Passamaquoddy language using the old language. So this is Peter Selmore, or we were lucky that there was a couple photographers back in 1890s that came around the community. There was a big movement nationwide about documenting all the tribal stories and songs and getting pictures of people before they disappeared. So below are some of the songs. And one of the important things with the wax cylinders, Fuchs just put a brief heading on each one of the songs, something that might be distantly related, but it wasn't the true title culturally of a song. So we were able to take this to our group of elders, balloon speakers, and they said, this is the name of that song. This is what it means. We had three war songs, and they just said War Song 1, War Song 2, War Song 3. But they were all different types of different times of the war, the pre-war, the war to get your people energized, and the war after the post-war where you've lost your warriors, and you're trying to make sure they're remembered. So we were able to put those titles on some of the songs. And I think what we have here is, Jane can play it.
Ready song.
That's Fuchs right there. He just called it general trading song. Trading is a big thing for all tribes back then. So you can imagine how that sounded on a cassette back in 1970. It wasn't that clear. And David did the best he could with what he heard. And to get it to this point, it's gone through a lot of technology. So the plan in the beginning was to get a group of elders that were fluent speakers together in one room and play one song. And that didn't work out too good. I'd recommend to any community to try different methods. It might work for another community, but for us, we had a lot of discussions every sentence. There was a large discussion, and I think it might have been 1 week for one song, just to go through it, and not everybody agreed with the words. So I thought it would be faster to have the youngest fluent speaker that could hear good, because a lot of our speakers are in the 70s and 80s. We happen to have the youngest fluent speaker is 50. So I wanted him to translate everything, and then we take it to the group for discussion. And that seems to be working better, because they can hear it a lot clearer when versus the, I play the wax cylinder first, and then I'll play Dwayne's song, and then they'll note the differences. So we've had minor differences on some of the translation, but that made it more powerful.
So I just wanted to just note these different kinds of rights that are recognized here that we wrote that aren't, they're not standard copyright rights, they're just the rights that Passamaquoddy assert over these materials. And the labels are here. The labels are translated into Passamaquoddy. This is kind of what the attribution label means. Eliatsik? How do you say it, Donald?
You can press the button. One of the things I like about this is we were hoping to make this a language teaching website also. So if you put all the words in Passamaquoddy, you're going to hear it and see it.
So that was like a beautiful part of the work done was this piece that Mukurtu allowed to make possible, and for Passamaquoddy to share what they want to share with the public, and also have be able to keep control over what they would like to keep within the community, which is also really important. And then I'll just wanted to show you two quick other things. So what I wanted to show was just some of the work at the library level. This is the photograph of Hukes, yep. Making those recordings that day in March 1890. And this is kind of what the online record looked like prior to this work. And I think what's interesting about this record is you can really see that there's no knowledge about the content. That's all about the wax cylinder, how long the wax cylinder is, and then Fuchs's, as Donald had said before, these kind of really limited titles for what these songs might be. And so as this kind of project, what the record in the Library of Congress now looks like is this, which is being able to include the Passamaquoddy titles of the songs and all the work that we did to kind of even get them to understand that it's a not get the Library of Congress to understand, but for us to also work through understanding that all the songs that were recorded are actually part of a war song series, not just one war song that's the same within all of the cylinders. But also you'll see the labels are very close to the content, which is really, really important for kind of giving the right cultural protocols. And I think this goes back to your questions at the very beginning, Jennifer, about why do cultural protocols matter? Well, cultural protocols matter because they provide the right guidance for how these materials should be heard into the future when they're being shared with the public. And the TK labels help make that clearer for publics that might not have any idea that there are cultural protocols. So they start to embed them in a different way into their own learning practices and their own knowledge about how Indigenous materials should be shared, and that there are cultural protocols that are deeply entwined with that response, and with that a responsibility for doing the right thing. But this is kind of what the MARC record looks like with the TK labels in it and the subfield 540, developed for to have the TK labels incorporated. This is the JSON file that now allows any item in the Library of Congress to have a traditional knowledge label, which is also an really important intervention for other communities who might have material at the Library of Congress. The work won't be so hard the next time because we've made an intervention into the digital infrastructure through this project that allows, so Passamaquoddy now allow, through the work with Passamaquoddy have kind of opened the space for other communities to now have this possibility within the Library of Congress as well. And then this would be the final one. This is kind of about transforming the rights recognition, and that the TK labels put the Passamaquoddy cultural protocols first. That's really significant. And it means that they're the first rights, they're the remaining rights, they're the present rights, they're the future rights, and they are there very present, not hidden in some other space. So that was kind of one important other dimension around this project. So, and I think on that note, I'll finish, I don't think, oh, and then this is what it looks like within the Dublin core. We, of course, use the rights field within the Dublin core for the labels as well. So for those folks who are into metadata, like some of us really are, this is kind of what that looks like for the TK labels as well.
Thank you so much, Jane, for sharing those visuals of the website and just of the data, particularly for those who are interested how that works on the back end for the repository, so that those who are just interested in those details kind of really understand what goes into to doing that type of work, and that it actually works and that it's possible. And that even when we work with, have to work within these structures, at least on the repository side, the non-tribal repository side, there are ways around doing this to ensure that those tribal perspectives and protocols are implemented at that level as well. And so we're gonna make sure to go ahead and share the Passamaquoddy site and the information about local context and the traditional knowledge labels, and just all the wonderful places that this project has been talked about and highlighted. So people wanna know more, they can look into that, and we'll share to do all of that. So thank you all so much. I just appreciate you doing this. I know all of you have to go, so. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you being here, and we'll share all your contact info, and just thank you for all the amazing work you do, especially to Jane, Guha, and especially to Donald for your continued years of work on this project. Thank you all so much. It's been a pleasure talking
to you. Thank you, Jennifer. Today.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lovely to see everybody. Bye.
Bye. Bye.